From Feature Story News in New York and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's programme, House Speaker John Boehner proposes a six-week hike in the debt ceiling, telling Republicans they can't fight the White House on two fronts at the same time. We talk to former Labour Secretary Robert Reich, who paints a dire picture of the future if the debt ceiling isn't raised.
It would subject millions of Americans who depend on Social Security and Medicare to terrible hardship.
Also today, why the Mayor of London wants to do business with China, the food deserts of California.
The options for folks in West Oakland to get healthy food are dismal. It's really bad here.
And the Nobel Prize-winning literature of Alice Munro. That's coming up on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's headlines.
From FSN, I'm Kevin McAleese with the latest world news. The Republican leadership of the US House of Representatives is offering a short-term deal to raise the debt ceiling for 6 weeks. Speaker John Boehner said the offer will stand in exchange for government shutdown negotiations.
So what we want to do is to offer the president today the ability to move a temporary increase in the debt ceiling in agreement to go to conference on the budget for his willingness to sit down and discuss with us a way forward to reopen the government.
White House Press Secretary Jay Carney reacted by saying the president is happy that cooler heads seem to be prevailing in the House. However, the Obama administration once again stressed that the status of the Affordable Health Care Act was not up for debate. The offer comes as U.S. Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew warned lawmakers that failing to raise the borrowing limit for the U.S. government would be deeply damaging.
Let me start by saying what I think should be obvious, that if we don't have enough cash to pay all our bills, we will be failing to meet our obligations, and under any scenario, we will be defaulting on obligations. There is no plan other than raising the debt limit that permits us to meet all of our obligations.
The father of former U.S. national security contractor Edward Snowden arrived in Moscow to see his son for the first time since he fled the United States in late May. Edward Snowden was granted temporary asylum in Russia soon after U.S. authorities charged him with espionage and theft of government property for leaking details of the NSA spy program to the public. Anya Ardeyeva reports from Moscow.
Lon Snowden arrived in Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport. He told reporters that his son deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. In September, the European Parliament nominated Edward Snowden for the Andrei Sakharov Prize, which honors figures who stand up to oppressive powers. The prize was awarded to Pakistani education activist Malala Yousafzai. Lon Snowden also said he didn't think his son would be coming back to the United States.
I'm not sure that my son will be returning to the U.S. again. That's his decision. He's an adult. He is a person who is responsible for his own agency.
Lon Snowden said he has had no contact with his son since Edward fled the U.S. in May, after exposing details of programs in which the National Security Agency mined phone and internet data from thousands of people inside and outside of the country. He added that he had received a multiple-entry Russian visa and that he hoped to return to Russia many times. Anya Ardeyeva, Moscow.
Libya's prime minister has urged calm after being freed by militia who had earlier seized him at gunpoint. Ali Zidane was taken from a hotel in Tripoli and held for several hours. It's thought his abduction was carried out by militia with loose ties to the government. Many militia groups in Libya had been angered by a US raid in Tripoli at the weekend to capture a suspected Al-Qaeda leader. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick has been given 28 years in prison for corruption after a series of scandals destroyed his political career. Kilpatrick, 43, was convicted of racketeering, conspiracy, fraud, extortion and tax crimes. Addressing the judge, he said he was ready to go so the city could move on. Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani teenager who survived a shooting by the Taliban for promoting education for women, has been announced winner of the 2013 Sakharov Prize. The award for freedom of thought, handed by the European Parliament, also considered former US intelligence worker Edward Snowden, and has previously been awarded to Nelson Mandela. Malala, now 16, was 11 years old when she began her fight for the right to female education in Pakistan's Swat Valley, where the Taliban regime bans girls from attending school. She became a prominent voice against the Taliban in her daily blog before gunmen tried to assassinate her in October 2012. Malala is also a contender for the Nobel Peace Prize. Sir Graham Watson is a British member of the European Parliament who first nominated Malala to receive the award.
She represents something that so many strive for, which is a girl claiming her right to be educated. We need far more people like Malala standing up and insisting that women have a right to be educated in societies where it is often denied.
And staying with the Nobel Prize, Canadian author Alice Munro has been awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. The Swedish Academy said she received the accolade simply for being a master of the contemporary short story. Speaking with Canada's CBC, Alice Munro said she was surprised by the news.
It is so surprising and so wonderful, and I had no idea of it. I don't think I knew that I was even on a list or anything until maybe yesterday.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Kevin McAleese reporting.
From Feature Story News, reporting today from our bureau in New York, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
It's time for leadership. It's time for these negotiations and this conversation to begin. And I would hope that the president will look at this as an opportunity and a good faith effort on our part to move halfway to what he's demanded in order to have these conversations begin.
The Speaker of the House of Representatives, John Boehner, announcing that he's proposing to raise the country's debt ceiling for 6 weeks in a bid to overcome at least one of the issues causing gridlock in Washington. He told a closed-door meeting of Republicans that they can't continue to battle the White House on two separate fronts, the debt ceiling and the government shutdown. So far, the Republicans are making no movement on that latter issue. And as furloughed federal workers and their supporters rallied outside the U.S. Capitol to protest the failure to end the government shutdown, two congressional hearings examined the potential domestic and global impact of refusing to end the shutdown and raise the debt ceiling. From Capitol Hill, Alice Ulstein reports.
The crowd gathered in the wet, muddy park across the street from the Capitol blasted the new Republican plan to keep the government shut down until they can win further cuts to social safety net programs and other government spending. Maryland Democrat Ben Cardin, who spoke at the rally about the pain felt by federal workers in his state, said the plan makes no sense at all.
This shutdown is hurting our country terribly. We've got to open government and pay our bills. Both are critically important.
Even those without federal jobs, like Maryland resident Barbara Booth, said they fear the impacts of a prolonged shutdown, especially the closures of the Food and Drug Administration, the Center for Disease Control, and the Federal Aviation Administration.
I'm very worried about the safety of our nation, and I tell you, I'm about to stop buying food at grocery stores because I don't trust agribusiness to do things. I'm not going flying anywhere. I'm not going to do any driving. I don't need to because, I mean, the things that people do that we don't see that keep us safe aren't happening, and I am very concerned about that. We all should be.
But many lawmakers and economists in Washington are turning their focus to the federal borrowing limit, or debt ceiling, which the Treasury Department says will be reached on October 17th. At a Senate hearing Thursday morning, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew explained that while some money will still come in from taxes after that date, the country will be unable to meet its obligations at home and abroad. He chastised lawmakers for creating what he called a manufactured crisis.
If Congress appropriates money, if Congress puts laws in place where people are entitled to benefits, if Congress commits military resources, once those commitments are made, you can't tell a contractor who's doing work, I'm not going to pay you because we changed our mind.
Lew said that if Congress fails to raise the debt ceiling, seniors won't receive their Social Security and Medicare checks, veterans with disabilities won't receive their benefits, some students won't be able to take out college loans, and the interest rates for home mortgages, car payments, and credit cards will skyrocket. At another Senate committee hearing Thursday, President Frank Keating of the American Bankers Association emphasized the potential impact internationally, including the possibility that other nations will be hesitant to lend the U.S. money, or that the global community would switch from the dollar to another reserve currency.
Default would also put the United States in the category of reckless debtor nations, that have broken their word in the markets. We should never inject uncertainty into the markets that we as a country will not keep our word and pay the debts that we owe. We must pay our bills on time and in full. If confidence is lost in our country's willingness to pay its bills on time, we will have lost something that may be impossible to regain, the world's trust.
But unlike House Republican leaders who today made raising the debt ceiling a priority, some Republicans in the Senate are downplaying the effect of a potential default. Wyoming's Mike Enzi mocked his colleagues' concerns, comparing them to saying, "The sky is falling, the earth will erupt." While Louisiana Republican David Vitter said the debt ceiling crises are a great way to win deep cuts to government spending. He reminded the committee that the last borrowing crisis in 2011 led to the budget sequester. The White House says they are willing to look at the new Republican proposal for a short-term debt hike, though they prefer a longer-term one, and wouldn't rule out signing it if it manages to pass a deeply divided Congress. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Yesterday on the program, we brought you both sides of the debate over the debt ceiling. The argument of the president, who says that failing to negotiate a debt ceiling increase will risk America's credit worthiness and send the global economy into a tailspin. And the argument of Tea Party Republicans, who say there's plenty of money sloshing around in the system to permit America to make good on its global debts, even without a debt ceiling increase. So who's right? FSN's Kevin McAleese spoke to the former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich, a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley.
No one knows precisely how bad it will be, but we shouldn't take the chance because the full faith and credit of the United States is a foundation stone of the global economy. If it is no longer tapped, then I would expect interest rates to spike here in the United States and elsewhere. And trust in the economic system generally to take a major hit. The Treasury bill and the dollar are, at least until now, the safest and most secure instruments in the world. If they suddenly become questionable, then we're all in trouble. How much trouble? We just don't know. But it would be terribly serious.
We also have voices within the Republican Party who challenge the notion of this so-called economic apocalypse. Is this a view that you think is going to attract growing support?
No, it's irrational and irresponsible. Those voices are saying that the president could continue to pay the nation's creditors the interest that they are due while reducing drastically payments for everything else the government does, including providing Social Security and Medicare. That's crazy. At most, it would buy only a few days and at the same time, it would subject millions of Americans who depend on Social Security and Medicare to terrible hardship.
In your opinion, as an economist, where is this situation ultimately heading if, come October 17, a solution hasn't been reached?
I cannot believe that the president would allow a default on the nation's obligations. If I were the president and the Republicans continued to hold the full faith and credit hostage to their demands, I would simply order my Treasury Secretary to pay the what the nation owed and disregard the debt limit. There is a constitutional provision that suggests In fact, more than suggests, it provides a clear justification for this initiative by the president. I hope it doesn't come to it. I hope before October 17th, cooler heads prevail. But I don't want to believe that a default is a serious possibility.
Former Labour Secretary Robert Reich on the line from his office at the University of California at Berkeley. Now, at a time when the United States is creating global concerns about its economic direction, China is very much open for business. Beijing has urged the US to resolve the deadlock over the government shutdown and the debt ceiling, perhaps keeping its own investments in the United States in mind. But the Chinese are also moving to assert themselves more prominently on the world stage and present an image of stability and certainty in contrast to the current US posture. The Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, is about to embark upon a trip to China alongside Britain's finance minister, the elegantly named Chancellor of the Exchequer. They want to attract more Chinese investment in the UK. And our London correspondent Natalie Feary sat down with Boris Johnson and asked him what he hopes his trip will achieve.
There is no doubt in Mayor of London Boris Johnson's mind about the ever-growing influence of China on the world stage.
When I was at school, I learned Latin and Greek. My children learning Mandarin Chinese, there you go. That's the way the world has changed.
Which is why in his first trip to China since the 2008 Beijing Olympics, Mr. Johnson will be looking to build relationships with businesses and officials in a bid to attract further investment into the UK's capital. China has already signed up to major new infrastructure projects in the UK in recent months. Chinese developer ABP will transform East London's Royal Albert Docks into the capital's third financial district. And Chinese real estate group Ni Zhao Xing plans to spend millions rebuilding London's Crystal Palace. A replica of the 19th century glass building is expected to house galleries, a music venue, conference centre and hotel. But with other major infrastructure projects planned, plenty more foreign cash is needed. These include a mega sewer system in London, a new high-speed rail network, nuclear power plants and offshore wind farms. And unlike the US, which has been rather averse to Chinese investment in strategic assets such as ports and telecoms, the Mayor of London says no UK assets are off limits.
I'm determined to have the maximum possible collaboration, the maximum possible partnership, and open to all sorts of investment. And, you know, there's nothing that's really off limits as far as I'm concerned, because, you know, we've got huge opportunities in higher education, in real estate. In technology.
Domestically, there are some concerns about overseas investment in strategic assets. But Victoria Barbary, the director of the Institutional Investor Sovereign Wealth Centre, says these should not be overblown.
They don't want to create a protectionist backlash against their investment. It's up to them to make sure they invest responsibly to keep the free flow of capital. So there's never a controlling interest. And with Heathrow Airport, obviously a strategic asset, but you've got Qatar, Singapore, Spain, Canada, as well as China involved owning that. So that kind of international feeling is much less threatening.
But while there is interest in UK assets, foreign direct investment from China has fallen. In 2012, the number stood at $6 billion, though year-to-date it has been less than half of that, according to the Heritage Foundation. Some blamed it on a very public meeting between the British Prime Minister David Cameron and the Dalai Lama, which was met with disapproval by Beijing. But Victoria Barbary says investments are not based on political reasons.
They don't have quite as much money to play with as they once did. And there have been some kind of high-profile failures of foreign acquisitions for state-owned enterprises in particular, which may have made them a little bit more cautious in what they choose to invest in.
Cautious too about current investments, particularly those in the US. Beijing has warned Washington that an agreement over the raising of the debt ceiling needs to be reached soon. But while concerns mount about the damage being done to the US economy and its standing in the eyes of foreign investors, some are seeing it as an opportunity for China to develop into an even bigger player on the world stage. And as its cash becomes even more coveted, the UK wants to be at the front of the queue. Natalie Feary, London.
This is FSN Reports. Libya's Prime Minister had a curious day today. Ali Zeidan was abducted from a hotel in the capital Tripoli and held for several hours by a group of armed men. No group has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping, and after the Prime Minister was freed, he called for rationality and wisdom in the country. It's not known whether the abduction was connected to growing public anger in Libya over the detention by US forces last weekend of accused Al-Qaeda figurehead Abu Anas al-Libi. FSN's Priscilla Huff talked to correspondent Will Crisp in Tripoli and asked him how the attack had occurred.
His hotel was stormed in the early morning around 3 or 4 a.m. by a large group of armed men. Then he was detained for most of the day, only being released this afternoon at around 1:30 in the afternoon. He surfaced at the Prime Minister's office after a military operation to get back. But he is proved to be a very resilient man. He appeared at a press conference today looking very tired. But he said that he wouldn't let this situation intimidate him in any way. He said, if this was about making me trying to make me resign, I won't do it. He described, and interestingly, he had a quick meeting with the General National Congress, Libya's Congress. Then he made a press conference where he said the incident was to do with normal Libyan political games.
This has to do with normal political games in Libya. Who is in charge in Libya?
Well, this is the problem. Over the last 12 months, the government, the security situation has really deteriorated, and this has curtailed the government's power in many areas. And this is, in the meantime, militant groups have really taken advantage of this, filling the security vacuum. So we're seeing federalists in the east who want to see autonomy for Libya's eastern region. They've taken control of key oil infrastructure, costing the government over $5 billion in lost revenue at a time when it sorely needs that money. And then we're also seeing Islamist groups as well, militant Islamist groups. And these are actually paid by the government, some of them, to provide security because the situation is so dire. Often they're protecting hospitals, supplying security, doing police checks on roads. These groups are filling these gaps. They also do charity work, working for the poor. One in particular, Ansar al-Sharia, which uses the same flag as Al-Qaeda, has become very popular over the last 12 months because of so much charity work. They're doing the things that the government can't do because of the gridlock and because of the government's weakness. They're sweeping the streets, they're looking after the poor, and they're spreading across the country, so there's more branches opening up in the west. So we've got the federalists in the east, and we've also got these Islamist groups seizing power just as the government loses power.
Will Crisp talking to us from his base in Tripoli. Now we're going to take a trip to the desert, not a place dominated by sand dunes, mirages and the occasional oasis, but a desert right in the heart of a major American city. Across the United States, the quest for healthy nutrition is often literally fruitless because of the existence of so-called food deserts, where economically challenged families can't access plentiful and reasonably priced supplies of healthy fresh food. FSN's San Francisco correspondent Rachel Silverman visited one neighborhood in the Bay Area where community advocates are trying to give low-income residents an opportunity to buy healthy food.
They call it food apartheid, a wide disparity in food access for those with money and for those without. In this Oakland neighborhood, many residents are disabled or poor or homeless. Here, there's an average of one supermarket for more than 90,000 residents.
The options for folks in West Oakland to get healthy food are dismal. It's really bad here. We have so many corner stores and liquor stores. They've got caloric-rich food, right? Things that can make you feel full, but they're not good for you.
The lack of fresh produce here spurred Barbara Finnan and a handful of other activists to develop the nonprofit City Slicker Farms, a program which has turned vacant lots into high-yield urban farms. Residents Richard Fuentes and Sean Sullivan say it has transformed the neighborhood.
We had, at this park in particularly, we had a lot of prostitution, we had a lot of illegal dumping, and the park has really just completely changed the neighborhood.
It transformed a drug den into a garden, and I think that is the best thing, that it's taken what used to be a poorly used park and it's transformed it for the community's benefit.
Once or twice a week, neighbors line up and pay what they feel they can afford for the weekly harvest of fresh fruit and vegetables. City Slicker Farms also helps people plant gardens in their own backyards. Regina Gooden is a disabled surgical nurse. She says having a backyard garden has changed her life.
It's like Eve.
I go and I pick them, go to my backyard, and I pick my own meal. If I want broccoli, I just go back there and pick a little broccoli. I pick a little herbs, with rosemary. It's magnetizing, and I love it.
Local residents contribute food scraps for compost, and most of the farmers at this community garden are volunteers from the neighborhood. Joseph Davis is a paid farm assistant and backyard garden mentor. He says at first, he worried about community backlash.
In the beginning, there was a lot of resentment because we were taking a park. But then once we planted it out and people started seeing things grow, from the kind of folded arm looking at us askance as invaders, it came to, you know, the two thumbs up. We love what you're doing a great job.
Unequal access to healthy food means the poor wind up eating more processed and fatty food and suffering the long-term health consequences. Programs like City Slicker Farms are sprouting up across the United States, hoping to redress the imbalance and to make fresh fruit and vegetables available to people regardless of their income. Rachel Silverman in Oakland, California.
Finally tonight, Canada is in celebratory mood after Alice Munro won the Nobel Prize for Literature. The 82-year-old famed short story writer becomes only the second Canadian and the 13th woman ever to win the award. Last year, she published a short story collection called Dear Life, saying it would be her final work before retirement. FSN's Rebecca Foster spoke to Ben McNally, owner of the Ben McNally Independent Bookstore in Toronto, and he says Alice Munro has a unique literary style.
Alice Munro writes stories of the everyday that encapsulate big matters in small spaces. She has an extraordinary reputation here amongst the literary community and the bookselling community, which I'm part of. She's really a wonderful person. She's been considerate and generous of her time throughout, and I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody who was more universally beloved in Canada, certainly among the writing community, than Alice.
So this is only the second time a Canadian-born writer has won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Canada's literary community must be feeling very proud right now. What are some of the reactions you're seeing?
The word on the street is ecstatic, to tell you the truth. I had like 10 different emails from various people out there in the world, and they're not writers, who are just basically celebrating.
And Alice Munro previously announced that her 2012 book, Dear Life, would be her last one. Do you think this award might stem her desire for retirement?
No, I think that she was serious about that. I think that she's ready to retire. I think she's probably pretty tired, and she's getting on, you know, like 82. I'm not that old, and I'm ready to retire myself, to tell you the truth. So I think, you know, that her husband had been ill for a while, and, you know, he died not that long ago. And I think that took a bit of a load off her back. But nonetheless, I think she's probably pretty much finished in terms of writing, you know, stories. She may pop another story out every now and then. But, you know, I don't think this award is going to be any major motivation for her to keep on writing.
Canada basking in Alice Munro's Nobel Prize for Literature. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can get in touch with us on Twitter. We are there at Feature Story. Or you can send us an email and let us know what you think of the program. The address is reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. On Friday, you think America had a housing bubble? Wait till you hear about the one in the Netherlands. That's on Friday's program. But for now, I'm Simon Marks in New York today, with FSN's Kevin McAleese producing the program back in Washington. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.